The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
It's an honor to introduce you to our speaker tonight, John Mulford. John is a professor at the School of Global Leadership and Entrepreneurship and director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at Regent University, that's in Virginia. He came to Regent University in 1982 as a founding faculty member of the School of Business and served as dean of the school from 1990 to 2004. And at various times between 1994 and 2002, he served as the Regent's executive vice president of finance and operations, overseeing all the business functions of the university, and as chief investment officer managing the university's endowment. He earned his B.S. in engineering and magna cum laude from Brown University and a Ph.D. in city and regional planning from Cornell University, where he was a National Science Foundation fellow. An interesting sidelight about our speaker today is he's a biker. In fact, I think in the first couple of years, he's just more recently kind of picked this up. He put in 4,000 miles in 2004 on his bike, and he does some of these 100-mile bike rides up into the mountains. So that's kind of an interesting little sidelight. This evening, he's speaking on the topic, Business as Mission, Strategies in Context. John, we're looking forward to what you're going to say today.
Well, I'm really happy to be here and to be talking about what is my passion right now, business as mission. You heard from my biography that I was dean of a business school for 14 years, and when I went to graduate school, I wasn't a believer. I was studying regional economics, and I was very interested in economic development. But most of the people that I was studying under were Marxists, so their view was you take it away from the rich people and give it to the poor people. And so it's just as well that God didn't release me to work on economic development at that time, but put me into a business school where I learned the value of entrepreneurship as the engine for economic development. And so in around 2000, I was talking with an adjunct faculty member in the school, Ted Yamamori, who at the time was president of Food for the Hungry. He and I both had this vision to have a conference bringing together people who are interested in entrepreneurship as a means of holistic ministry. So he spent a lot of time traveling around the world, so he gathered up several dozen people who were active in this field. And we had a conference in 2002, which was really exciting because a lot of these people didn't realize there was anybody else working in the same field. And as a result, outcome of that, we created something called the Kingdom Business Forum and then founded this Center for Entrepreneurship at Regent. And that's our focus is starting and developing businesses in developing countries. So I'm going to need someone to punch the slide since I had to put my computer way back there. If you just hit the down arrow, this could serve as a mission and vision for business as mission in general and also for the center at Regent. Our mission is to improve the economic and spiritual condition of disadvantaged populations through business grounded in a Christian worldview, or in a nutshell, transforming people and nations through kingdom business. The vision then is communities, regions, and even nations revitalized spiritually, socially, politically, and economically. Just to give, so I'll be on the same page, the definition of kingdom business is a business designed to facilitate God's transformation of people and nations. Kingdom businesses transform people as those people experience God's unconditional love through the business. Now that's kind of an interesting thing to say. Most people don't think of love and business together. In fact, once I gave a seminar at our local transit authority, they'd asked me to come down and talk about business ethics to them. Well, I was talking mainly to bus drivers and lower level employees in the company, and at one point I said, you know, the real key thing is love. And they all looked at me like, what is this guy talking about? Love. But as we got into it, they really liked the concept. You know, that if you love one another, you'll treat each other in a better way, the business will work better. And by the end, they were really excited and they said, the only problem is you're talking to the wrong group. You need to be talking to the bosses. They need to learn about this love stuff. So if a business does show unconditional love to the people that come into contact with it. Those people observe consistently godly behavior by the people in that kingdom business, then they're able to hear the truth of the gospel from people who are living the gospel. That's the way transformation happens through a business. So transform people, then transform nations. Because the gospel is contagious. It's almost like an infection, you know, that the owners can infect the employees, and they can infect the customers, and they can infect their friends and neighbors, and you can have a pandemic going on, you know, of the gospel spreading. Also, transformed businesses tend to succeed because God's principles work. And therefore, those businesses are going to do well, and aspiring business leaders are going to study them to learn their secrets. Whether or not they're Christians, they're going to see this business is doing really well, and they're going to want to know why, and then they're going to get exposed to the gospel. And finally, particularly in developing countries, I just realized I didn't turn on my microphone. Anybody couldn't hear me? How's that? Is that better? Okay, you won't have to scream. Particularly in developing countries, oftentimes the business environment isn't really that conducive to succeeding in business. But if you're successful operating by God's principles, then you'll have a chance to witness to government leaders, and governments may modify their laws and policies to encourage more kingdom businesses because they want business. They want success. They want to see people getting jobs and their economy increasing. Well, then business as mission becomes a tremendous mission strategy for the 21st century. If you look at it, first of all, free market capitalism is accepted worldwide. That doesn't mean that democracy is accepted, but even in China, very capitalist system now. Virtually, except for just a very few countries that are doing very poorly economically, capitalism is accepted worldwide. Secondly, development aid has been a failure. The World Bank published a report recently that said, basically, we give up. Development aid doesn't work. The only answer is business. Business is the only way to improve an economy, not to just give development aid. Thirdly, kingdom entrepreneurs bring what a country wants. Countries are asking for jobs and economic growth. And they also bring what it needs, the gospel. Even though it may not know it, people in the country aren't asking for that. They are getting blessed by it as they're getting what they want, which is also jobs and growth. And finally, kingdom business is self-supporting, and it interacts with local people in a very natural way through commerce. And so it's not something where you have to have an awkward situation trying to figure out how am I going to relate to these people that I'm trying to witness to. It's just a natural relation through transacting business. Now, this isn't a new concept. I put a quotation in here from Charles Spurgeon. Has anybody heard of him? Charles Spurgeon lived in the 1800s. This is what he had to say. I have often noticed that any place where there's a little business doing, where there is little business doing, is bad for religious effort. All along the Valley of the Thames, there are places where a man might preach his heart out and kill himself, but there's little or nothing of good being accomplished in those regions, just as there is no active business life there. Kind of interesting. I never thought of him as being a business as mission guy, but he noticed that if there's no business, it's very difficult to have much happening in terms of evangelism and the gospel. Now, here are some classifications of ways you can be involved in business as mission. So I'll just quickly define what these are and then go into describing a little bit about them and talk about some examples and how you can use them in different contexts. First is tent making, which is as old as Paul in the Bible, who called a tent maker. How many are familiar with tent making? Okay, just about everybody. In the mid-90s, I started a program in the business school called Entrepreneurial Tent Making, thinking, what a great concept. It was sort of business as mission's forerunner. And the only people enrolled in it were divinity students. Didn't get any business students. And they all came and said, oh, we really like this. You know, we can't get into such and such country, and if you can just get us in there under the cover of business, oh boy, this will be terrific. And I said, well, that's not what I'm here for. You know, I want people who are called to business who are going to do a good job in business. The problem with that approach was you'd get people who had no interest in business, no skill in business, and wouldn't work very hard, so they weren't good witnesses in business. You know, they might have been great church planners, great evangelists, but if you go as a business person and say, that's what I am, and then you don't do a good job of it, what kind of a witness is that? So I've had quite a problem with tent making over the years just because of the way it's been implemented. Second area is multinational corporations. I mean, they're operating all over the world, and there are a tremendous number of postings where you can get a job in another country and have all kinds of opportunities for doing mission-type work. I'll talk about that a little more in a minute. Micro-enterprise development. How many saw that the founder of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh just won a Nobel Prize? Okay, he was a, sort of one of the grandfathers of micro-enterprise development. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute as well. Small to medium-sized enterprises be the next step up from micro-enterprise, where you don't just have a sole proprietor, but you have a small business that might have 10, 20, 50 employees. And then the last one, overseas private equity, is a larger scale business that takes significant capital investment, probably has more sophisticated managers, might operate in a world market. So let's take these in turn and take a look at them. Well, I mentioned, I've pretty much already given you this information about the tent making, tends to focus on evangelism at the expense of business. Receiving countries, and we're hearing this quite a bit now, they'd rather have a business person than an evangelist. And so even if you're supported, you go to a country, you're bringing in your own support, so you figure, I'm not a drag on that country. But the people there are kind of looking at you, what are you doing here? You know, how do you get supported? You just seem to hang around, you're not even working. Or you're working 10 hours a week, but you say you're in business. You know, I see business people working a lot more than that. So it sets up kind of an odd structure. So one of the things I see is a future for it, more for bivocational pastors than for missionaries. Because if you go to a lot of developing countries, the pastor's flock just doesn't have enough income to be able to support the pastor. And so the pastors pretty much have to work. Wouldn't it be nice if you could create a situation where the people that were in their congregation had good jobs and could support the pastors naturally rather than having to, the pastor either having to have a whole separate job or people having to pump money in to pay for the pastor, but you could be paid naturally. Okay, multinational corporations, as I said, they're postings for skilled professionals all over the world and many opportunities to minister in and through these jobs, but what I've noticed is, well, for one thing, the jobs are very demanding. So if you have a mindset of, I want to go to this place to do missions, and you're working like crazy for a big multinational company, and you're spending all your time doing that, you may feel as though you don't really have much time to do the other kinds of things you want to do. However, there are some tremendous opportunities that I think people are overlooking, because their mindset is, I got to get outside the company to do some kind of ministry, when they could be doing it within the company where they are, overseas. But what I'm seeing then is that some missions-oriented people tend to be migrating to these other things, SMEs and OPEs, and working for a lot of alphabet soup here, isn't there? Non-governmental organizations, in part because the multinationals that they're working for are not necessarily Christian organizations. They're big, secular, for-profit multinational corporations. And so they don't really participate in any kind of a national business as mission strategy of how to strategize transforming this country. Okay, micro-enterprise development, again, has a widespread, it is widespread and has a long history, but the economics of it are very difficult because how many have ever worked for a bank or know much about banking? Anybody? One. If you want to make a loan to somebody, you need to know something about them to be sure they're going to pay you back. Well, you need to know almost as much if you're going to lend the person $100 as if you need to know if you're going to lend them $100,000. But if you're going to make a loan of $100, you can't really afford to do too much looking around and checking into them before you've already spent more than they're going to pay you in interest for that loan. And so it's very hard to have these tiny loans, these micro-enterprise loans, be able to support the administrative overhead to administer them. So people talk about, oh, we've got a program that's sustainable. Generally, what they mean by that is it will pay the overhead costs of administering it without paying anything for the money that's being loaned, because most of the loans come from gifts, and so they don't have to be paid back. I mean, they're paid back to the microfinance unit, but they're never paid back to the people that gave the money originally. They're just recycled. So it's hard to run these things in a sustainable way. Now, they have helped millions of people. There's no doubt about that. you go into some places where the people had nothing and could not support their families, and be, by just a very small loan, they're able to do something that enables them to provide for their families. So they're tremendous in that respect. But you look at Bangladesh, where the founder of the Grameen Bank was from, and they've done millions of loans themselves, and yet you don't see the country being transformed. So why is that? You know, why isn't the country transformed if so many millions of these microenterprise loans by Christian organizations are given out? Well, I'll get back to that in a minute when I'm talking about SMEs. But in my view, the MED serves in a somewhat relief-like role in impoverished areas that don't have very many opportunities for larger scale businesses because there's almost no infrastructure, the people are so poor, perhaps they don't have much education, and so rather than just handing them something, some food, you hand them some means for being able to generate their own food. And these MED programs could be a feeder for the small to medium-sized enterprises. A year or so ago, I met with the president of the Opportunity International Bank in the Philippines that had just had about 250,000 loans out, microenterprise loans. So I asked him, do any of these people grow businesses that are, you know, larger businesses? And he said about 3%. Well, that's 7,500 businesses that are sizable, not huge businesses, but up to the small to medium size category. So it seems as though you could have sort of a funnel effect. You know, you have a huge number of microenterprise loans, then you have a smaller number of small to medium size, and then you could end up with some larger businesses if you worked in a chain with them. Okay, small to medium size, the concept is you start with some jobs and you have a potential for many jobs. Now, these types of businesses face similar complexities and challenges as larger businesses, and so they require more sophisticated training. If you're doing a microenterprise loan and you're giving someone enough money to just go out and buy some produce and sell it that day at a slight profit, and then the next day go out and buy a little more and sell a little more, that's pretty basic, and you don't need a whole lot of sophistication to be able to do that. But as soon as you start having people, you got problems. And so you need to have a little more sophistication as to how to run a business once you start having employees in a little larger businesses working with banks and other financial institutions. Well, with a good business environment, these SMEs can grow to be huge companies. How many know the story of Dell Computers? Michael Dell started in his dorm room at the University of Texas in Austin. Now it's a huge company. You know, Bill Gates and Paul Allen started Microsoft as a pretty small outfit. Now it's Microsoft. Walton started Walmart with just a couple of small stores. So if you're in an environment that allows it, you can start these small to medium-sized companies that may get started in a developing country could potentially grow up to be huge companies. Now, the environment isn't that great, oftentimes. And so what happens is you almost always need missions-minded investors, because I saw this happen quite a bit. For instance, when the Berlin Wall came down, I said to one of our trustees who had he had a contract with McDonald's to supply all their lettuce in the eastern United States. And he had started some farms in Europe, and he was doing some work in Europe, and I said, hey, what about going to eastern Europe? He said, are you kidding me? You know, why would I want to do that? There are plenty of opportunities in western Europe, and they're just not ready to do business in eastern Europe, so I don't want to do it. He didn't have a missions-minded investing idea. He just wanted to invest where you could actually have a good business and make money. So if you're going to find people to invest in some of these other countries, they're going to have a missions component to their thinking, or they're not going to want to risk their money. Now let's look at the types of projects you might have with an SME. This is comparing it to what an MED would do. So in rural areas with agriculture, an SME might be a herd of animals versus one animal for a microenterprise loan. Or it might be a tractor instead of a hand tool. Or in a village or a small town, it might be a sewing factory instead of a sewing machine. Or it might be a bakery instead of baking bread at home. Or it might be a grocery store instead of being a street vendor. So that's sort of the difference in scale going from microenterprise to small to medium-sized enterprise. In a city or metro area, it'd mainly be services. So it could be something like selling used cars or having an oil change shop or a print shop. Could have a web developer. Could even have a business school.
Question.
Yes?
Can we get the slides after somehow?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can email them to you if you want. Or you could, if you have a USB, you can just download them. I met a guy in Ukraine, young guy, who had his own private business school. So I was talking to him, and he was really gung-ho, and he gave me all this information, real detailed information about how much he paid his faculty and how much it cost to rent the room and how much he charged tuition. And I was just mentally doing all these numbers in my head. I said, "Wow, you've got a good business." He said, "I've got a terrible business. I can't make any money." I said, "Sounds to me like you have some pretty good margins here." And he said, "Oh, I forgot to tell you. I have to pay off the top, off my gross revenue, 35%. I said, "Well, who do you pay that to?" "To the holding company." I said, "What's that?" It was sort of a euphemism for protection, so that you wouldn't have the government and people coming around and trying to shut you down. You have to pay 35% of your revenue. So here's an example of how tough it is to work in some environments, where this guy seemed to have a good concept that could have made money, but because of where he was, it made it very difficult to make money. Okay, overseas private equity, the concept, is to create many jobs from the start. And these companies might often be connected to a world market, and if they are, then they're going to have to be world class in order to compete. You can't just open up any old thing and expect people to buy your product around the world if you're not meeting the standards that other people are meeting. So this is requiring sophisticated investors and skilled professional managers. There's a lot of potential here, though, to influence not only the local market, but even a whole nation. Because sometimes in a small country that has a small economy, it doesn't take a whole lot to have a pretty big company. And that company might be one of the largest companies in the whole country. And because of that, you get a lot of attention. And people are going to want to talk to you, and you're going to have a chance to influence them. Now, some types of projects that you could have. One would be just a multinational expanding into another country and building and operating a plant there. Another one would be foreign investment in a local company, usually providing money so that a local company could expand in that country. Or you could do a joint venture where typically the developed country technology partner would partner with a local person that knew operations and knew how to handle the local environment, and so you'd have that kind of a joint venture. Or you could do an international franchise. I've seen this more and more as an opportunity because if you think about it, you have a large population of people that need economic help. But are they all going to be potentially great entrepreneurs? I mean, just look around at the people you know. How many of them are great entrepreneurs versus people who are just really good at working in another company? So wouldn't it be nice if you could help some people have a business where they didn't have to start everything from scratch, but they already had a good business model at work? Well, that's basically what a franchise is. Now, I was in Ukraine meeting with another guy who had started a franchise of Korean massage beds. And he had gone from 0 to 80 of these franchises in 6 months. It really got the attention of some Western investors, and so he was negotiating with Curves for the franchise opportunity for 5 countries. Does everybody know what Curves is? The workout place? Well, so there's an example of how franchising might be a way of really jump-starting business in some economies that are hard to start in. Now let's look at some examples, particularly of SME and overseas private equity. I'll just try to give you a few examples to give you a sense of how some of these things might work. Well, you might help locals to start businesses, and there are many non-governmental organizations, ministries, that are working around the world trying to help people start businesses. One example is Breakthrough to People that's operating in Ukraine. It's basically one guy who's taken this on, and he started about 22 businesses in Ukraine now. His model, I like his model though. It's a good model in that you need to have somebody on the ground. He looks for a missionary on the ground to go around, meet with pastors, and have the pastors identify potential entrepreneurs. So he'll get, say, 40 pastors, 40 potential entrepreneurs, bring them together, have a meeting where he'll bring in some Western business executives to give them a sense of how a pastor and an entrepreneur can work together and be partners in, not officially partners, but can partner in the idea of starting kingdom businesses. Because in Ukraine and in a lot of places, the two mix like oil and water. The pastor looks at the businessman as corrupt, which most of them are, and ungodly, and how could I have anything to do with that person? And plus, if I let him in my church, he's got all this money and he'll try to control me. And so I've got to be in charge of all the businesses. And then the businessman is looking at the pastor and saying, I'm being judged, you know, these guys don't know what they're doing. And so they don't get together. But by doing it at the outset and showing them a biblical worldview of how they two can work together, you at least have a chance that they're going to end up working together in the church. So from that, out of those 40 people, you might get 8 or 9 that generate business plans, viable business plans. Then this one guy who runs the thing says, okay, got these business plans. He comes back to the U.S., starts running around church to church, and he finds 4,000 here, 5,000 there in order to fund these plans. Now, some of them are really working out very well. One guy wanted to have a sawmill, so he needed about $3,000 for a saw. So he got him the saw for $3,000, and before he cut his first piece of wood, he took the entire saw apart. He made a little map out of every little part, and then he had somebody make him another saw. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm getting ready for expansion. You know, I want to have another saw before this one wears out. I want to have two saws. Well, now he has, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 saws going. He's got 16 people working in his sawmill. He started a soccer league in his city. He planted a church. And so he's a moving force in his area where before he wasn't doing anything. So that's one guy.
So the money raised in the U.S., are these considered investors? Are they grants?
No. These are, this particular model, and I'm glad you asked that question. What he does is he gets $5,000. He says, would you give $5,000 to this effort? They say yes. And so he takes the $5,000, he gives it to, in this case it was $3,000, to the guy with the sawmill. And he says, now, we don't have a contract for this, but they've already been identified as people of good character in the church. And so he says, your job is to get a good business going, and I want you to take 10% and devote that to the kingdom, and 10% I want you to put into a fund, because after 5 years, this thing's got to sustain itself. We're not going to go to the United States and keep bringing back $5,000. So what they do is, the first year, it's all U.S. people or all Western people coming and doing the training and bringing in the money. The next year, some of those successful entrepreneurs come around and they're observers for the training the second year. The third year, they're kind of assistant trainers. The fourth year, they're the trainer with an observer from the West to sort of help them out. By year 5, that's it. They're doing the whole thing themselves, and hopefully they've put enough back into their fund that they can fund the new business ideas that are coming along. So the idea is to make it self-sustainable, not dependent totally on somebody coming from the U.S. to support it. Another guy had a farm, and he needed a tractor. So he said, my goal is to employ everybody in my church. Well, he had a pretty small church, but that was his goal, to employ them on his farm. So they got him the tractor, and sure enough, employed everybody in the church. And by the way, the church started growing like crazy because they said, there are jobs over there at that church. You know, so everybody just started pouring in. This church ended up having more baptisms than any other church in basically in the whole Ukraine. So they got lots of stuff grown, and then they went to harvest the land. They needed to bring in a harvester. Well, the harvesters didn't want to do anything for him because they didn't like it that he was a Christian. So they said, well, why don't we create a harvesting company then? And we'll harvest your land and some other land. So they're building a vertically integrated business, because then once they harvested everything, they said, you know, we don't like the prices we're getting for our grain. Well, let's have a mill. You know, we'll mill our own grain, create our own flour, and we'll sell that. So they're building the same thing with the sawmill. They've now got a furniture maker that they're supplying, and that guy's making furniture and then selling it. So you can get multiple businesses going out of one business. So that's an example of locals being helped by an outside organization. Now, the one part that to me is a little bit of the weak link in this model is that the person on the ground, see, you bring in all these Westerners and they give the training, but then they go home. And they're working away on their business plan. But I was in Ukraine a month after this guy came through with his first training, and I was talking to somebody, another businessman. He said, yeah, all the people that are supposed to be doing the business plans are coming to me, asking what to do. Because the missionary who kind of gathered them up and coordinated them really doesn't know how to do business plans. So it'd be better if you had a person who knew business in that role rather than someone who was a missionary that didn't have business knowledge. Then if you had that, over time what you could do is get that position to be supported by the businesses that are being started, because that person could be a consultant that's going around to the businesses and helping them. And eventually that could be a paid position supported by those businesses. Second idea is foreigners that are living in a developing country and they just decide to start businesses there. I was in Morocco. By the way, I'm sure that coming to Urbana, you understand that when you're talking about countries that don't want Christians, you don't talk a lot about the things that are going on in those countries. So I'm not going to tell you their names, but even so, you probably shouldn't talk too much about things that are going on in places like Morocco to people that you don't trust. This guy went as a missionary. And he quickly found out it's hard to be a missionary in a country where it's against the law to convert somebody. So he started a computer business. The computer business was going pretty well, and he had quite a few people working for it. But then he noticed that there's tremendous opportunity for land development because they're right on the Mediterranean, and across the coast of Spain is very built up and very expensive, and on Morocco's side, it's not very built up, so much less expensive. So he started selling condominiums for a Moroccan developer. And in a couple of months, he sold 200 or 300 by tapping into the British market. He would give a percentage to the British real estate companies that sent him referrals. And boy, he just got referrals like you wouldn't believe. And they were selling these condos for around 70,000 versus 300,000 or 400,000, just 6 miles across or 9 miles across the Mediterranean. So things were going great. Then the Moroccan developer said to him, you know, we're not really doing this the way we like to do it. And that is, if we're going to sell something, let's say $100,000, we say it costs $60,000, and then the other $40,000 you just sort of pay under the table. And that's the way, you know, my fellow developers said, you know, they don't like what I'm doing, and we've got to change it. And so this guy that I was talking to said, okay, but you're going to have to get somebody else to sell them because, you know, that's not the way I do things. Whoa, wait a second. You know, you just sold 300 units. I like you. You know, let's see what we can do. He said, well, what we can do is do it the right way, which is, say it costs $100,000. I don't know, you know, tell me why I should do that because I'm going to have to explain it to these other developers that are all angry with me. So he got to explain a Christian message of how to be honest to this guy, not saying he was a Christian, but just saying this is good business because if I'm going to buy one of these things for $100,000 and you say it costs $60,000, what happens when I want to sell it for $150,000 and the person says, well, you only paid $60,000? You know, why should it have gone up that much? So he said, oh yeah, I can understand that. So he went and told the other developers, you know what? We really ought to be doing it this way. We've been doing it wrong all this time. So here he is getting Christian principles spread around through the Moroccan developers, even though he doesn't say it's a Christian business. He has a vision to really transform the country through the tourism that they're doing along the coast. Not only building up lots of developments, but also all the peripheral businesses that they'll need. Hotels, restaurants, laundries, stores, and to be almost a Christian conglomerate that can help develop jobs and businesses for the local people. Well, you can have foreigners that extend their own business into a developing country. Did anybody go to the business plan competition? A few of you. If you did, you heard about a company that's working in Laos. We've been working with them. They saw our website and called up and just wanted to know what we were doing. And when we found out what they were doing, we said, wow, you know, you're doing some neat stuff. And I asked them, these are some farmers in Iowa who had been supporting missionaries in Laos, which is a communist country. The missionaries were going to be kicked out. So they said, well, why don't we just put an animal feed mill there, and then you missionaries can stay there and run it. And that'll give you a reason to be able to stay there. So they did. They had these farmers run, have farmed soybeans, and they have soybean mills in Iowa where they create flour and different specialty flours out of soy. So they built a mill in Laos, and they talked to some farmers and said, how about growing soybeans so we can mill them? Okay. Got time to harvest. They went around. No soybeans. Said, what happened? Where are the soybeans? They said, oh, we didn't really think you were serious. You know, we didn't believe you, that you were going to buy them. Oh, well, we'll buy them, you know, but you need to grow them, so next year. You know, so they had to wait another whole year. And next year, they got the soybeans. They bought them. They milled them. They went to sell the feed, and the people said, we don't buy feed. You know, nobody buys feed. You just throw out whatever's left over to your chickens or whatever. Nobody buys feed here. Oh, so you can see they didn't do a very good market research. So they said, well, I guess we're going to have to build some businesses then to take the feed from our mill. So they started doing some chicken hatcheries, fish farms, things like that. But that is taking a lot of their resources they're having to bring in from the United States. I mean, a lot of money. When along comes the World Food Program, World Food Program buys up surplus grain and gives it to people that are hungry. So they said, well, World Food Program said, we have a project that's happening right in northern Laos where you are, where we want to feed school children this corn-soy blend. Do you think you could provide that? Well, they had to build another whole mill to be food grade. And they said, okay, we'll do that. So they built another mill and produced this corn-soy blend for the World Food Program. And it looks like it's going to be a great model because the World Food Program said, this is really nice. You've got local farmers. You've got a local mill run by local people that's being used locally rather than shipping in something from the U.S. or Canada or something like that. So it has great potential, but not just the economic model, but the spiritual impact has been phenomenal because the people that are working in the mill, for the most part, are Christians, and they're evangelizing their neighbors. One of them they sent out to a food storage place near the farmers, and that guy started five churches. Now, that kind of got the attention of some of the regional administrator type people, and they didn't like it. They didn't like all these farmers being Christians. So they said, if you're Christian, you can't farm. So the farmer said, well, would you put that in writing, please? And so they said, okay. They did. Well, it happens that the Constitution of Laos says there's religious freedom, so they took it to the national capital, and they said, no, they can't do that. So they took it back to the regional guys, and they said, you can't do that. And the regional guy said, okay, go ahead and farm. And then he got back to the local area, and the local guy said, I don't care what they say. You can't farm. You know, if you farm, I'm going to kill you. So they prayed, and they said, what are we going to do? You know, we want to farm, but we don't want this guy to kill us. So they prayed, and they decided they would bless him by going and building a roof on his mother's house. And so here this local head of the local village sees this, and he said, wow. Here I am persecuting these people, they're turning around blessing me. I think I'll let them farm. So he said, okay, you can farm. Well, through all this, everybody else saw what was going on, and they saw the power of God's love, and so it caused a revival. Hundreds of people came to the Lord. As a result of first this resistance and then this change, just tremendous effect. So here is something that hasn't quite worked out as a business model yet, but it's having tremendous spiritual impact in an area. And finally, you can do foreign direct investment in local companies. I've been talking to a German man who's he's trying to raise a venture fund right now just for Ukraine. It's pretty interesting. He was giving me all the details of his fund, but I also knew his story of what he'd been doing in Ukraine. And I said, now how are you going to be able to convince anybody to invest in Ukraine? Because his story was he went there in 1993. With an idea to help people in food technology. So he went to the German government and they funded this program. Then he went to German equipment manufacturers and they gave him, donated lots of equipment like bakery ovens and meat processing equipment. And he created these institutes and ended up founding dozens and I think about 40 bakeries. I'm not sure how many meat processing outfits. But what happened was, they set it up as a Ukrainian company, and along the way, somebody who worked there just was disenchanted with the company, and they took some of the official company stationery that, unfortunately, the Ukrainian guy had already signed, and they created some loan documents as if this company had borrowed a bunch of money and not paid it back, and then they took those to court and said, hey, they owe us money. We want to seize all their equipment. So the German guy said, no way, you know, you're not taking our equipment. They tried to fight it in court, but it was too late by then because the judges had already been paid off and everything was basically done. When one day, somebody showed up at this guy's apartment and said, at the German's apartment, and said, I hear you're having some trouble. People are trying to rip you off. And he said, yeah, it really makes me mad. He said, well, for $5,000, I can kill them for you. And he said, well, no, you know, that's okay. I'm not really into that. He said, well, for $2,000, I can just get them put in jail and you'll never hear from them again. He said, no, I want to do it the right way. Well, the right way didn't work, and at least not initially. The police came and seized all the equipment. They shut up his factory and just cut off the electricity, closed it down. He had freezers just full of meat that they didn't get to in there for a whole year. You can imagine what that was like. And then after a year, they had permission to buy the equipment back at a reasonable price. Of course, I mean, they shouldn't have had to pay anything for their own equipment. So I said to him, you know, if that's your story, you know, how are you going to convince investors that they ought to invest in this fun, you know, it doesn't sound like it's such a great place to invest. And he said, well, first of all, there are a lot of companies that are doing well in Ukraine. I mean, there are some booming companies. He said, I would never invest with people that I didn't know for a long time. But I have 10 projects already identified. One of the guys is one of these bakeries that started out of his institute, and the guy now has 50 bakeries, and he wants to expand more. So he has people that he knows that he can trust and that he can invest in. And so that's how he's planning to do his, you know, with his fund. Now, I haven't checked my email lately, but he was trying to raise $100 million in this fund by next May. And he said if he didn't have $5 million by now or about now, he didn't know whether he was going to continue. So I hope the next email I get says he's got some money, because it's a very exciting thing. And there's some great opportunities for Christians to be investing in places like Ukraine, even though it's a tough place to work. And these are just a few examples of the places around the world. There are lots and lots of things going on. In fact, I teach a course, in two courses in international entrepreneurship. One focuses on import-export, and the other focuses on starting businesses. And oftentimes the students, since they take the course by distance, they're already there doing things. I have one guy who was in Japan, and he said, my idea is to buy used cars in Japan and ship them to Kenya. Well, it just so happened that the researcher in my office is from Kenya. When he found that out, the two of them started talking. He said, hey, I think I'll just try it, you know, during the class to see if it works. So he bought a car, shipped it to Kenya, went into partnership with the person that works for me, who has a partner on the ground in Kenya. You know, just got it all set up to sell that one car, worked out pretty well. And so now they're going to do a couple of months and then try to increase and do more. So that was just one example of somebody doing business cross-culturally. Another guy started a company in Egypt during the semester, and he was living there. He started a cloth diaper company using the Egyptian long fiber, cotton fibers. And so he was telling me about all the issues he has to face in doing business in Egypt. But lots of opportunities around the world for people that don't mind getting into places that are somewhat risky or very risky, and walking the tightrope, but trusting the Lord for the results. So that gives you just sort of a sense of what's available out there and the different kinds of levels of things and different types of environments that you might operate in. But I'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments or things you'd like to talk about.
You mentioned that Bangladesh hadn't been transformed by the micro-enterprise. And that you kind of discuss why that was the case. I might have missed it.
Okay.
How'd that work?
Well, if you look at micro-enterprise, it's essentially a self-employment approach. You have someone who doesn't have anything to do, and you give them the ability to support their own family, which is a fabulous thing to do. But most of the people that are doing that, by the way, it's, I think, you know, 98% women. They don't have the ambition to build a big company. You know, they're not a Sam Walton who wants to build a huge company, or a Michael Dell or a Bill Gates. They want to feed their family. And once their family's fed, they're satisfied. So that's most of the people in microenterprise. As I said, with this one, there were 3% that grew companies that grew to have some employees. So there are going to be some people who say, oh, this is working, I really like business, and they're going to start growing things. But there's not a natural mechanism. Nobody's really paying attention to look for those people and try to help them build those companies. They're just sort of satisfied to have the microenterprise work and the person have a job and pay their money back. So there's not really an expectation that it's going to create jobs for other people. That's the problem. It's creating self-employment for a lot of individuals, but it's not an engine that can grow and create jobs for other people. Yeah.
You talk about you had online courses in your school. Can you talk about more on what courses you offer?
Well, we offer, just in the area of business, we offer an MBA, and then in the area of leadership, we offer doctor of strategic leadership, a PhD. So you can get, and we also have an undergraduate program. So you can get anything from undergraduate degrees up through PhDs, all of them online. Anybody else?
Well, I have a question more along the lines of microfinance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was actually going to ask the panel a question in regard spoken to, but my understanding that there's various levels of poverty. You know, right now, I feel like that this may be a general assumption, but currently, a lot of the MFIs are focusing on like the middle to above the poverty line. So people that aren't in extreme poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question or concern is, do you believe that that the focus on the focus in development and investment on the above poverty line will trickle down to the extreme poverty levels? My main concern is, the extreme poor presents a higher credit risk for banks and MFIs.
Right.
But I guess my burden I have is, we should be developing the extreme poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're almost neglecting that.
Yeah.
But I feel like also in the other side, MFIs think that if we focus on the less credit risks in the above poverty lines, then their effect will, like their wealth will trickle down to extreme poor. Now, how do you see that? And I guess my question is, how can you or how can MFIs effectively reach out to the extreme poor?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. Anytime you have a program that's helping disadvantaged, there's always this tension between, shall we make the program go to somebody who doesn't need it quite as much as the other people because we want to have success. Success being that our program works and we can point to somebody who did well. If you go to the person who's the worst off, there's such a distance they have to be lifted that oftentimes it may not work. And so, or you have to work a lot harder to lift them up. And so there's a natural tendency to go to the ones who might have been able to make it even without you and say, look at what we're doing. There's just that sort of a human tendency to want to have success. Now, I don't really see that microenterprise is going to have a great trickle-down effect because, as I mentioned, it's primarily a self-employment approach. Now, that person may have a little bit of income that they could use to buy from somebody else, but that somebody else isn't going to be the super poor person. So I would say you'd be better off, if you want trickle-down, to create the next level up of small to medium-sized enterprises that could then perhaps have a goal to employ some of the poorest of the poor. So that would be one approach. Another approach would be something I saw in Malawi, where a church just adopted these orphans in another village. There were 900 orphans. Now, they're orphans, but they were living with either distant relatives or people who just took them in. So they weren't just out on the street, but they were in very bad shape. They didn't have much going for them. And so this church said, well, we're going to help you by giving you some things to plant some gardens. Well, they had no irrigation in this area, and so they created irrigation for their own little gardens, just something the size of this room. But when that thing was growing and everything else was brown, they had to put up fences around it and get guards and everything because it became so popular and everybody, wow, look at that. And then build them some houses and just basically build a community. So it was a church saying, we're going to the poorest of the poor and we're going to help them just a little bit at a time. It didn't fit anything like the kinds of businesses I'm talking about, but it took people who might have died otherwise and just lifted them up so that they had a roof over their head and something to eat. So that might be similar to what you're talking about. Anybody else?
Don't know exactly quite how to phrase this. I'm a graduate engineering student, not in the business world so much. Could you speak at all how engineering might work with these entrepreneurship businesses, and also how business students could potentially work with engineers, just thinking how engineering is so much a function of having a product that is marketable, solving problems, how they might work together at all?
Well, I'll just give you one example. When we did this conference in 2002, an engineering company in Dallas sent somebody to it. There were Christians that ran this environmental engineering company. And when they got the idea that, hey, we can be doing business as mission, they just got excited.
Yeah.
And they started, setting up some nonprofit organizations, doing lots of things with their own organization. And they were in the business that was easily applied to things like clean water and handling wastewater and things that were really needed in a lot of the developing world. Well, their company has been expanding tremendously. And just this last October, they put on their own conference. And they've started a Christian publishing company, and they're doing all kinds of things. So these are engineers, but they, you know, they were in business. So I think there are opportunities for engineers, particularly because there are a lot of engineering type needs in these developing countries, just to have a built infrastructure, to have clean water, to have sanitation, you know, those kinds of things, depending on what kind of engineering you do. Or if you happen to be in electrical engineering, you know, there's all kinds of telecommunication things you could be working on. So I don't know if that gives you a few thoughts, but I don't have anything, you know, sure, of where to sign up.
Question from my perspective, I'm actually a theology student right now.
Mm-hmm.
More from the business direction. In the relationships between churches and businesses in other countries that you've talked about here and some of the other examples that you have you seen, I'm listening to you talk about how the church is affecting the community through the business that they're sponsoring or working with the membership. Have you seen any direct changes in the structure or the model of, I guess, ecclesiology, the model of the church being changed by interacting with that business itself?
Are you talking about the church in the local area or the church here that's sending?
I would say both, and but I'm really more interested in the local area.
The one in the target area. I don't know that I have enough knowledge about that to really give you a good answer. I do see oftentimes the church being so affected by the models that the evangelists bring to them. You know, so they think they need to have a model that looks like the model in the U.S. when maybe that's not the right one. And this idea of business working closely with the church is still fairly rare, where they have a very good working relationship. It's still, I think, more of a distrust and a difficulty. You know, they kind of rub up against each other not quite the right way. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that there are going to be changes. I mean, if you read in the U.S., the marketplace ministry stuff that's going on, you know, Peter Wagner's writing that the church is going to be out there, not in the building, but it's going to be out in the marketplace. That scares pastors. But, you know, it's... So I don't know if they're even thinking about that in the developing countries where the church is starting. I just don't know that. Anybody else? Yes?
Do you know any specific examples of SMEs in China, specifically like rural areas outside of major cities?
Rural China.
Just smaller.
Smaller businesses?
Smaller. I guess location doesn't mean like Beijing, Shanghai.
Uh-huh. I know there's some... The things that I know about are primarily U.S. people doing training. You know, they're either running schools teaching English, or they're running leadership training, or they're running consulting-type training. I'm not as familiar with people going and helping the local people start businesses. That's not to say it's not happening. You know, there's so many things happening around the world that I don't know about that it's very likely something's going on, but I'm just not aware of anything off the top of my head.
One of the topics I've touched on a few other seminars is really the tension between the entrepreneur and the vision standing agency. Folks have to figure out how to work with each other.
Well, I'll give you an example from the guy in Morocco. He was sent by Frontiers, raised his support, and I think it was last year, one or 2 years ago, he wrote a letter to all his supporters saying, I don't need your support anymore. I'm supported. I've got my own. You know, I've got businesses that are supporting me. There's no point in my taking your money. However, you know, if you want to keep sending money, I've got some good ideas of things that it could do here in Morocco helping other people start businesses. He got back letters saying, I've never had a missionary send back and say they didn't need support. So here was an example where an entrepreneur, he's an entrepreneur, but he went as a missionary who was being supported by a sending agency. And he's now saying, I still want to work with you, but I just don't need to be supported in the same way. Well, he already had a good relationship, so there wasn't so much tension. It was kind of like, oh, you know, that's something that we can support somebody else too then. So that was a good relationship. I think when you have someone who has no existing relationship with a sending agency, and he just says, I'm an entrepreneur, I don't need you, then that's a hard way to start, you know, because how are you going to get together? You know, how do you need each other? And I think to some extent, traditional missions agencies are threatened by business as mission, because, you know, I presented it as a new way of missions for the 21st century. That's not to say that traditional missions is no longer needed. It's just saying that there's a place for this new approach, and the two can work as complements. But I haven't really seen it too much yet, you know, having seen them work in a complementary way. But there are all kinds of opportunities. And I think one of them is if the entrepreneurs can show that they're going to generate income for the local people that's going to come back into the church. Because to me, that's the answer. You know, it's not sending in money from outside the country to support the church locally. Now, that isn't a good long-term solution. So if the entrepreneur can say, I'll help you generate a self-sustaining local church, that could be a place where they could come together, you know, and have something. Yeah. Well, no, I don't. But see, I don't think all missionaries ought to be entrepreneurs and businessmen. I mean, they might be entrepreneurial, but they don't. Not all of them should have as their goal to raise enough money to support themselves. Because to me, see, this guy didn't say, "I need to raise my support, therefore I'll go get a job." That wasn't what he was thinking. He was saying, "There's just no way to do what I want to do unless I dig in and just become part of the society and start creating businesses." And he liked it. So it was a very natural thing for him. So that's fine. But I think it'd be terrible to send a missionary out and say, you have to become a business person even though you don't want to be. That's not what you're good at. You're not called to do that. And you're going to have all these unhappy people trying to be something they're not. So I think there's still a place for them to be supported either from here or from businesses that somebody else started locally. But that, not that everyone has to either have a job or have a business to support him. And in fact, I'm seeing way too much of that. When divinity students come to my office and they say, I just need a minute of your time. Would you just show me, I need some kind of business where I can get it going and then it just keeps paying me lots of money and I don't have to do anything. And I say, What are you talking about? You think that's the way business is? You know, that you just like that and it just pays you money when you don't do anything? You know, business is hard work. And yet they have this mindset. Somebody's told them, oh, business is the answer. You know, it's going to provide all your money and you don't have to work. It's just sad, you know, to hear that. So I kind of laugh when people come by and ask me that. Anybody else? Well, we don't have to use up all the time, but I'm happy to stay as long as anybody else wants to.
As a business person, besides starting a business, how do we provide spiritual impact to the
world? You mean if you're doing business?
Right.
Well, in a number of ways. One is through, remember I said that kingdom businesses transform people through love? And so, by loving the people that you come into contact with as a business person, that is your employees, if you're showing them, and this is so easy to do in a country that doesn't respect people and respect workers, if you show respect for the people that work for you and you show that you love them and care about them, you're going to be so different from every other business that's around. People are going to say, what is going on over there? I want to talk to that guy and find out what he's thinking about. So then you get to just tell them why you're doing that. You don't have to go out and hold a rally or something. People are going to come to you. So from the way you run your business and caring about people and running it from a kingdom perspective, you're going to be very attractive to people. And then as you succeed, you're also going to have a platform. This company in Laos, even though it's a small little company from the perspective of the U.S., it's the largest company in the whole region in Laos. So they get a lot of attention. you know, people want to know, they want to talk to them. Whenever they want to talk about business and development, they go to them and talk to them. So you get a lot of influence working in business that you wouldn't get as a missionary. And you get to, so you get to say what you think and why you think things ought to be the way they are. And you also get to speak into people's lives, the ones that work closely with you, people that you have contracts with, suppliers, customers. They're people that you can influence and change and for the gospel. So it's a very natural way to do things.
One other question. Well, one thing we were, my wife and I, concerned about if we go over some type of a business standpoint, and if we don't go with a mission such as Frontiers, you know, who keeps you accountable to make sure there's a spiritual component to it. Have you seen people who have gone over more, not as a lone ranger, but more from a business standpoint without a mission that keeps them accountable? Do they spend all their time in the business side of it, or do you find the natural outcome to be...
That's a very good point. I was talking to someone recently who said he's working at a much higher level of investing a lot of money in companies, and he wants them to be kingdom companies. He said, I found a company in China, and we found a Christian. We wanted to pour ourselves into this guy and create a business. Well, they did. They created a business, but the business took off so much that the Chinese guy just forgot about them, you know? I mean, his business is just zooming. All he can think about is business and how much money he's making, and it's almost like they've created something worse than what they started with, because he's further away from the Lord now than he was when they met him. So there is always that danger, and there could be that danger with anybody when they go into business. And one of the things that you need to have then is accountability, peer accountability. But if you don't have it with a missions agency, you ought to have it with other Christians in business. And one of the things that I think is very important, you know, for people going, but also for the businesses you're starting, is some kind of a peer group that meets together regularly. In the U.S., there's a group called C12. It's groups of 12 Christian business owners that meet together, and they talk about how can we have our businesses really glorify God. And they meet regularly to be iron sharpening iron to do that and hold each other accountable. Well, you can have the same thing, you know, if you go somewhere. You need to find something like that. That's a very good point. Well, two more, and then we'll close out, but I'll still wait in case anybody wants to come up.
You talked a lot about starting businesses.
Yes.
And cross-cultural contexts. Are there any examples that you're aware of, or any recommendations that you have for purchasing a business instead of spending the time starting it, finding something worth buying and getting started for that?
Yeah. Either buying or investing in. That's what this... fund, the German fund in Ukraine is going to be, it's not going to be startups, it's going to be expansion of existing businesses. And particularly when you go to a place like Ukraine that had a lot, huge amount of industry that was obsolete, but there's a lot of capital sitting around, plant and equipment and thing and people that are trained, you don't need to start from scratch. You know, you can reconfigure a lot of what's already there and expand it. So, yes, that's happening.
We have a booth over here, and I'll be there from 11:30 to 6:30 tomorrow. We'll be out of Mark. And if I'm able to ask any questions, please, if you're interested in business, we do have a new global MBA program that's starting in fall 2007. It's a great program, especially for those who really are interested in business. I'd love to talk to you guys. If you're interested, we also have a leadership program, all of which are available. So, if you're interested, come on. Or go on the website,
wizard.edu. Okay, well, thank you for coming.